Okay, this hour now we'll take your phone calls with Peter Canova and Tricia McKinnon as we talk about destiny and creation. That's all next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. Peter, before we take calls with you and Tricia, let me ask you a couple more questions about the origin of mankind. Do you believe we were genetically seeded as well? You believe in the Sitchin theory?
Well, I won't. I'm going to give you a yes and no answer. I believe
did I hit a nerve here or what?
Well, Trish and I have talked about this, and I think her feelings about this are a little bit more decided than mine. I think it's a possibility. I think the one thing is in the area that I concentrate on, it really deals more with the consciousness and spirit and the roots of the material world in consciousness and spirit. And
cosmology.
So the spirit, the Sitchin materials are pretty physical in their orientation. I mean, the Anunnaki are physical beings, and humankind was, seeded genetically and so forth. But, there's so many levels that you can look at this on, George, and that's why I never dismiss anything outright. I think there is truth in the Sitchin materials. Now, do I agree with every aspect of it, that it was all done physically by extraterrestrials who seeded Earth with their own DNA and mixed it with ours? It's possible. I think it also could be allegorical to the fact that we discussed in the Casey materials in the Nag Hammadi Gospels that that spiritual entities manipulated the primates on this planet in order to get them to a point where they could receive an influx of spirit. Now, that could also be read in some ways into the Sitchin text. It could be, part of the echoes that are lost in the mist of time, but they came from a common source, and it was read one way or interpreted one way by the Sumerians and in other ways by Casey or the Western practitioners of the mystery religions. So what I'm saying is I'm not saying no, I'm not saying yes, I'm saying it's a maybe, it could have happened that way, but there's other ways that it could have materialized, and they may not necessarily be at odds with one another. They may be sort of echoes of a common story lost in the mist of time.
I also would like to address that a little
bit.
Sure,
go ahead, Trish.
Because, we have the Anunnaki story, we have Edgar Casey story, we have amazing material, really, as I said, from Dolores Cannon, who didn't make it up. She simply, put people into these deep states, and many of them had off-planet experiences, and some of them had come to Earth from these planets. We also have the Billy Meyer material, which comes down, Billy Meyer's a one-armed Swiss farmer from Austria who started having contacts with extraterrestrials, the Pleiadians, that look just like us human beings, from about 1975 on. And, he was never a very public person, very reclusive, so he didn't really get the message out very well, plus he doesn't speak English. He speaks Austrian or German. But his material, the Pleiadians, really claim that that human life began 22 million years ago in Lyra, which, interestingly enough, we call the Eye of God. And when our north celestial pole is oriented into alignment with Lyra, we actually are receiving energies from the center of the galaxy. So we are much more in a golden age in those cycles. But anyway, they said that they went through the same kind of, millions of years worth of wars and fighting and colonizing other planets and, everyone's ego getting out of hand that we are, and that apparently this is part of the infancy and the teenagehood and the young adulthood of all human societies. And eventually there were people who broke off from there, came to the Pleiadian system, started a life there, and then some of those people came to our planet and were involved, actually very actively involved in Atlantis. And this is interesting because in my readings, I have seen that Atlantis was like a star capital where there were people coming and going from the Pleiades, from Andromeda, from Orion. I mean, Mamma Mia.
It was like an international airport, wasn't it?
Exactly. So we, in terms of the pinnacle of consciousness on this planet, there was, as Peter said, I think in Lemuria we were much more femininely based and more intuitive. By the time we got to Atlantis, we finally moved over thousands of years into more masculine science-oriented were magic, because I think we were vibrating in the fourth dimension, which still had homes and families and children and babies and probably some form of money. But our accessibility to the laws of vibration, sound, and manifestation was easier, because, you know, as you descend into the density, like in the third dimension, there are 48 laws of physics that have to be obeyed unless you are a master and know how to transcend them. In the fourth dimension, there are only 24 of those laws. So maybe we were coming down from the fourth slowly through the sub-octaves into the third. So, you know, magic was, as classic magic, was more possible if you knew the true name of something. This is what the languages of light were about, like Sanskrit and Hebrew, where the sound created the shape of reality.
Okay, let's go to some calls here. They're lining up for both of you. First-time caller, Chris, is truck driving in Oregon, and he's on Coast to Coast. Hi, Chris.
How's everybody doing tonight? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing, Chris.
Hey, Chris, you driving in a truck?
I sure am. I tell you what, you know, I'm a new believer to Christianity, and, you know, I'm definitely a guy who doesn't have it all figured out, but some of this makes so much sense to me. It seems like Christianity these days is so narrow-minded. So, I mean, this, I don't know, it just, it was a great topic. It really hit home, and for some reason, I just wanted to call after I heard your voice, Tricia. I just felt some type of connection, and I wanted to see if, you know, I could get your information, so maybe I could, you know, contact you for a little bit more of a personal experience.
It'd be my pleasure. You know, Peter and I both have websites. Mine is www.trishamcannon.com or Tricia McCannon Speaks.
And if they miss it, it's linked up at coasttocoastam.com.
Yeah, and he's got one. And also for people who are interested in the subject that George and Peter and I are talking about, we've got a link on to an email you can send, which is mysterymatrix101@gmail.com. And anybody who goes to that, actually, I have, you know, you asked me at the very beginning of this show, George, what I was up to. Well, I had so many people who wanted this mystery school material I've been teaching for the last 7 years here in Atlanta, and I have people who fly in to take it every 6 weeks. I decided to finally do an online class, and so this year I've created 800 to 150-page e-books.
Wow.
That will go up online in the next couple of weeks, and the very first Introduction to the Mysteries, which is 54 pages, anybody who goes to that mysterymatrix101@gmail.com, they can log on and get that for free. And then if you go to my website, and I have a new site coming up in about 2 weeks with all these discourses, you know, you can do that. But by all means, you know, you can write me, email me, give me your phone number. I'll call you back. I'm happy to talk with you. And you should pick up the book on Jesus, because Jesus was awesome. I mean, he was really, I think he was the real deal.
You know, George, you have such a fantastic website that every time Tricia on, the responses and the queries crash our site.
Oh, yeah, we do that a lot.
Yeah, so we set up this special email, the mysterymatrix101@gmail.com, for those people who have further inquiries, and that way we'll be sure to get it, because that has enough bandwidth to accommodate all comers.
All right, super. Next up, let's go to Eric in Palmdale, California. Eric, good morning. Go ahead.
Yeah, hello.
Hi.
Hey, Eric.
Yeah. Well, you know, I have a problem with the concept of sin, that these institutions, you know, they make you want to feel dirty.
You are right.
And disgusting for having been born. And, you know, let me tell you something. All these institutions that make people feel this way, okay, they're evil. And yep. I'll tell you why they're evil. Because, first of all, the female in this world, okay, has a major role. They don't understand, these retards don't understand, okay, that, see, it is absurd, because the female has to be impregnated by the male, and then she gives birth to the male and the female. It's a very absurd concept, very difficult to grasp, but that is the reality. So when they make you feel like you're filthy, you were born out of, you know, your mother and your father met and had sex, and, you know, and then you were born. And I mean, this is disgusting. And these people, they go, you know, they pontificate and they, you know, tell all these stories, these fascinating ancient, you know, the stories of, you know, the some mythological thing. And, you know, I mean, where does all this guilt come from?
You know,
let me set your mind at ease about the whole idea of sin, because you're hitting a real point here. Yeah, it was Orthodox Christianity came up with this concept of original sin, which essentially says, you know, you're guilty for being born. But the real original Christian concept of sin meant something very different. Sin literally means to be in error, to be off the mark. And the only sin in original Christianity was the sin of forgetting our own divine source and thinking that we were just material bodies. That was the only sin to the ancients. And so the cure for that was knowledge. The cure for that was remembrance and enlightening ourselves, re-enlightening, regaining the light to understand the true source of where we came from. So, you know, it's kind of an aberration. This whole idea of original sin was kind of an aberration of a particular sect of Christians that, you know, unfortunately kind of caught hold and spread around, but it was not the concept of original Christianity.
And I also think that one of the reasons that women were made, you only really saw this happen once, like you said, I think you had some pretty twisted people in the early days of the Catholic Church, St. Augustine and Tellerton and some of those guys that were early church fathers, they had some issues with their sexuality. So they made sex dirty, and of course they made the desire for women dirty, and they taught women that they had no worth, and they taught men that to really desire women, that they should only desire them to procreate the species. And, you know, I really think that sort of the underlying thing behind it is through true sexual union between two people who love each other, you transcend the boundaries of the body. The man becomes the woman becomes the man, and you can actually have out-of-body experiences that are transcendent spiritual ecstasy. And you don't need the church, you don't need a government, you don't need anyone telling you anything. You can actually experience God directly through sacred tantra.
That's the tantric yoga.
And so they took it away. I mean, how better to take it away than to make everybody feel guilty and ashamed?
Well, remember, the more you're made to feel guilty and ashamed, the more you can be controlled, because then someone comes to you and says, I have the cure for that, and it's usually the church.
Okay, let's go to Ryan in Los Angeles, west of the Rockies. Ryan, go ahead, take it away.
How you guys doing? Can you hear me?
Good, sure thing.
Cool. Dreams for me have always been a major gateway, very powerful, very potent, very long-lasting, but it all started when I was really young. I'd say like 3 to 5, I had this visitation from, I'm not sure who it was, but I would be laying in on my bed, and all of a sudden it would feel like everything is moving very fast around me, except for me, and then I would kind of get like sucked out. And then I would be outside of my body, and this kind of misty black doorway would appear, and kind of like a big gate, and like a hole, like a stargate, or, you know, anyway, this black figure, very dark figure, would come through that hallway, whatever, and start reaching out to me, and I would scream, and then scream and scream, and it would go away. It's not like it wanted to hurt me, but it was this kind of a large figure wrapped in all black cloth. It looked like all black cloth, just wrapped up, and I don't really know. I can still remember it like it just happened. Yesterday, it was so powerful, and it happened several times, and I can't explain it. I have no idea who that being was.
This was a figure that you were afraid of, I take it?
I was afraid of it, but it didn't want to hurt me. You know, it wasn't trying to hurt me. And my whole life, I've been very sensitive, very aware. I've had a lot of psychic experiences, you know, all that. kind of stuff, but
if I can address a little of this, you know, dreams are really one of the big gateways where we do drop our consciousness from beta, alpha, into deep levels of theta and then delta, which is why when they've done it dream experiments where they stop the theta-delta connection, because delta is the higher self where we plug in to God, even though we're not aware of it, when they interrupt those cycles, people become emotionally imbalanced. So that's it's very important. I actually have done a whole discourse in this Mystery School series on astral travel, soul travel, and the magical worlds of dreams, because there's many kinds of dreams, from just sorting to processing our emotions, the subconscious, the precognitive dreams, the past life dreams, to actual dreams where you connect with your higher self, with your spirit guides, and actually with deities on these higher levels. And, of course, as you look at all the dimensional planes, there is a band of the lower astral where there are kind of the boogie people that we see so much in the horror movies of TV. It's just a narrow band, but you have to know how to pass through the band.
That's the archons that we talked about in the Judeo-Christian Gospels.
So it's very important, you know, it's all vibration, and if you... the fear actually attracts them. So you have to create a strong connection. And, of course, Christ is a really powerful energy. You know, you can call in your guides, your angels, your higher self, your Christ, Buddha, whoever it is that you conceive of to be the highest frequency for you. And just establish this connection between your third eye and, let us say, the great central sun, the source of visible illumination, pull it down around your body, ground it through your body into the earth every single day. And as you build that shield, then you won't attract the dark energies, if they are dark energies, or if you do, they'll just bounce off. And there's specific ways where you can literally challenge a being, that's, and you can say, if you don't come in the name of the Christ vibration, you know, be gone. And if they come in that name, they'll stick around. And if they don't, they have to leave.
Yeah, another simple way to deal with that, because there was a period of time I was actually living in a very, very rough part of Africa that had a real history over it in West Africa where the slave trade was. And it was almost like a dense cloud, you know, was always hanging over the place. And in my meditations, I would really get invaded by a lot of these, you know, kind of negative images. And I would just literally, you know, put myself in a globe of the white light, and I'd have it get stronger and stronger going out from the center until it radiated everything out and essentially, you know, kind of blotted everything out. And I just, you know, knew myself to be in there and you know, that would be the highest and the best place for me to be. Because remember, using your imagination doesn't mean it's not real. Imagination is a tool that we use in order to connect ourselves to the higher energies. And to the extent that you put yourself within the fold of that white light, it actually does have a real effect you know, throughout the planes to help you. And it's just a very simple technique.
Okay, stay with us. Coming back for final phone calls in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, on our next Coast to Coast program, we're talking about lost civilizations and more ancient secrets. Almost part two on Coast to Coast AM. When we come back, let's take some final phone calls. When we come right back. Tricia, where do you go next with your research with this?
Well, you know, this whole thing about doing the mystery schools and writing these books so that we can bring this ancient knowledge into the 21st century and make it accessible for everybody, everybody's interested. This has really become one of my great passions. And when I set up the mystery school, the Phoenix Fire Lodge, about, oh, I don't know, six or seven years ago, I would never have even done it if I had not had Thoth actually appear to me three times and ask me to do it. And he appeared in the dream state, came in the dream state. And, of course, at that point, I really didn't know that he had set up all the mystery schools on the planet. You know, I knew he'd set up the one in Egypt. But it took me about a year to figure out a format for it. And so I started here in Atlanta. And the mysteries were taught in three levels. And the first level was the divine feminine, the second, the divine masculine, which is part of what we have in Christianity, and the third was the union of the two, which brings us into balancing the left and right hemispheres of the brain, activating our third eye, awakening our inner senses and being able to see into the inner worlds. So this year, along with traveling 7 months of the year, and I'd like to not travel quite as much as I have been, if possible, I hope to put out about 20 podcasts that people can download, which would be great, maybe more. And I hope to finish all 12 of these first 12 discourses. I've got about 8 done, and like I said, they'll go up in the next couple of weeks. So that seems to really be my mission, is to try to get that out. The second level of the mystery schools that I teach is all Egyptian. So it uses the framework of, you know, some of the, let's say, Isis representing love, and Hathor representing healing and sound vibrational therapies, and Nephthys representing the shadow that lies within us, and Horus representing truth. I mean, they become representations of archetypes that live within us.
All right. And how about you, Peter? What's next for you?
Well, I have a pretty active speaking schedule around the country, and I post that on my website. As I mentioned earlier, I'm writing the screenplay for the first book, Pope Annalisa, because I'm getting so much interest from different quarters in Hollywood right now. And I'll be working on my second book called The 13th Disciple. Now, I'm writing a trilogy, and it's called The First Souls Trilogy, and it's actually pretty close to what we're talking about tonight. Many of the themes in there literally deal about the first souls to incarnate in material experience, and it talks about their lives through different incarnations or, you know, different epics. But really, it's an allegory for you and me and all humanity about our origin, destiny, and purpose for being here.
Okay, back to the phones. Let's go to our wild card line, George in Allen Park, Michigan. Go ahead, George.
Hello, everybody.
Hi.
Hey, George.
Now, what I want to say here is with respect and love and sadness at the same time, but you're saying, like in the Old Testament and in the New Testament, that female Eve gets the bad rap, but that's not true. It says in 1 Corinthians 15:22, in Adam all die. And it talks about in Romans that by the disobedience of one man, not one woman, that Adam was not deceived. Eve was, and she was cut some slack for that, but Adam was not deceived. He willfully sinned, and he brought the curse on the earth, and that's why the virgin birth had to take place, because in it, the woman of sorts becomes the hero, because God said to the woman that your seed shall crush the serpent and bruise his head. And a woman is not to be subjugated. Religious people do that, not true Christians. You're to cherish and love your wife. She was taken from the side of Adam, not from his back. She's not to stand and walk behind him. She walks beside him. The only time your wife is to walk behind you is when there's danger in front and you intercede in that danger. And everybody keeps talking about the serpent's the hero. It's the same lies. The serpent is the consummate con artist, that he gains your confidence and makes you think he's your friend to enlighten you. It's always the same thing. It's like the virgin birth was necessary because of original sin, and the sin that was through the blood of Adam, the blood that was in Christ. It says in Acts that it was the very blood of God, because the blood of Adam was tainted. And the serpent, it's always the same lies, that sin is like a lack of knowledge. It's a missing the mark. It does say that, but it's also a willful transgression.
Well, see, I don't think the serpent is being hailed in this conversation. Peter?
Yeah, well, first of all, let me just say one thing as far as Eve is concerned. I think what we're really talking about, George, is not so much Eve getting a bad rap in the Bible as much as how the Bible was interpreted and how women were essentially treated in the Christian church or the Catholic church in the early days when
right.
They were kind of
in reality.
Position is in reality. So it's people's real interpretation of it. You know, as far as the serpent is concerned, there's a number of traditions that portray the serpent in a much more positive light than what we were told was the role of the serpent in the Bible, including what it says in the recovered Gospels and Nag Hammadi, that the serpent was actually a symbol of wisdom. And you know, look, it's a point I think in a lot of ways that it depends on your own personal reading of truth in what the Bible says. And I'm not going to sort of argue with somebody because I respect what your, you know, view of that is. If that's the truth that you get out of it, then that's really what you need to, you know, what you need to go with. What I'm saying to you is that there was another version, there was another view out there of what the serpent represented, and that wasn't only in the early Christian text, but it was evident in several other cultures around the world where they had a more positive interpretation of the symbology of the serpent.
Yeah, if I can just sort of address that, a lot of what you said I think was very beautiful, and I want to thank you for, you know, being so honoring and acknowledging, and I think Peter also speaking to the point of it is that, you know, it's more how the patriarchal interpretation became suppressive. But back to the whole serpent thing, you know, a lot of animals were used as hermetic symbols to convey deeper esoteric truths. For example, the lion is connected with the great lion of God, the lion of Judah and Jesus, and the line of the lineage of the priest kings, the courageous one that's connected to the son of God, the illumination. The serpent, the qualities of the serpent are that it sheds its skin in order to grow to the next level, and it's similar to the spine and the kundalini energy. And so there was a very positive interpretation about raising the kundalini for awakening. But there's also the interpretation of the serpent as something that's a venomous, poisonous, you know, lay on the ground. So it definitely is one of those symbols that's had both very positive qualities that are high and wise and very negative qualities that are very treacherous. And so it's understandable how anybody could argue for either one of those conversations. But I think going back to the Anunnaki gods, it's quite possible that the story in Genesis, which is at the very end of the Enumud Elish, which was really, you know, about Enlil, who had Lord of the Command over those Anunnaki gods, being at odds with his brother Enki. And Enki, being a geneticist, had taken the symbol of the serpent because it represented DNA, kundalini, enlightenment, et cetera, et cetera. They had taken that as their house symbol, and the term, if you go back far enough, serpents of wisdom were kind of like doctors or scientists, like one-eyed serpents and two-eyed serpents were like one-star general and two-star general in science. So I think that part of the reason we have that interpretation is because Enlil's family hated Enki's family, and they didn't approve of the genetic experiments, really, for their own political reasons. They didn't, you know, I think Enlil felt like it would give Enki too much clout with their dad. So it's a complex subject, really, that has a lot of history behind it. But I understand what you're saying.
Okay, next up, let's go to Gary in Houston, Texas. Gary, good morning. Thanks for holding.
Good morning. I'm not trying to start a conspiracy, but a couple of weeks ago, you had a guy on that was talking about the Ark of the Covenant, and they thought they'd located in the middle of Africa. And my question is our current president has sent a couple of troops over there, two set of troops that are, we don't know what they're doing, but they're in the vicinity, they're armed with teeth. And what kind of power comes out of the person that actually takes possession of the Ark of the Covenant? And I'm not asking if he could be looking for it, but what would happen to whoever takes possession of the Ark of the Covenant? Is there anything in your studies that talk about that? What happens to who takes possession of it? What it does to the world?
The classic idea is that the Ark itself is vibrating or emitting, whether it's at a subsonic level.
It's like a power source, right?
It's a power source, and that basically anyone whose vibrations of the atoms of their body are not attuned to that vibrational source could be destroyed by it. Just like if you were, let's say, on the negative side around uranium, it could permeate your body and make you sick. I'm not saying this is uranium, but the people who have been the keepers of the Ark historically are people who were priests, who were like yogis. They meditated all the time, and they raised their frequency to a point that they could endure being around whatever that frequency is. But most of us are not living lives where we are, you know, meditating 8 hours a day.
Well, you know, the Ark was said to be, believed to be, the home or the temple of the living God of the Israelites, just like the Holy of Holies at the center of the temple of you know, of Solomon. And you know, I think it's hard for us to say exactly what would happen if the real ark was discovered. We have to theorize on it. But look, I think there's truth in what Tricia says, because the mind frame that we enter into any new experience, whether it's going into a church, whether it's going to a very holy site, has very much to do with the kind of experience that we will have, you know, in a place like that. So, you know, clearly, I think that that whether you believe that the Ark was the home of the living God, there are so many people throughout the ages that have had that thought form built up around that object, that there's surely going to be some kind of energy attached to it that people ought to be aware of if they're going to come around it.
Okay, next up, first-time caller, Eric in Los Angeles. Go ahead, Eric.
You got a best show. I learned more than you than I did at UCLA for all the years. I want to tell you, I'm sorry what happened to you in Mexico. What I do now is I take my phone, I take a picture of the plate of the driver, and I said, if I don't get to my destination by this time, I said, everyone knows who you are.
Good idea.
A couple people kick me out of the cabs, but I haven't had any problems. I want to ask a question to the guests. We've heard, I've heard talks of energy, of macroevolution, of energy, and I just had a question because I read the book of Revelation, and more of a personal question, do both of the guests believe in the resurrection of Jesus Christ?
I believe that, yes, and I talk about this in the book I wrote, Jesus, the Explosive Story of the Three Lost Years and the Ancient Mystery Religions. I know it's a huge mouthful, but what I believe that Jesus did when he studied at these mystery schools, all the mystery schools taught about seven subtle energy bodies, except in Egypt they knew of two additional bodies. And it, the mastery of those two bodies allowed you to actually die and to resurrect your body. And it was they were the highest two bodies. So this is something that almost nobody had been able to do. It's very, very seldom that anybody could accomplish it, because it took complete commitment, discipline, and mastery and dedication. So I believe that Jesus did die, and in a physical way, and literally had the power. And he says it in the New Testament. He said, I lay down my life and no one takes it from me, and I take my life back again. So I believe that he literally was able to remanifest a form that he could then change, because afterwards he was seen by his disciples as a little boy, as an old man, and then as a man that walked with the disciples for a whole day before they realized that they were walking and talking with him.
I kind of concur with Trish on that. I do believe in the resurrection. I do believe that the energetic body that was reconstituted could either have been completely physical, or it could have been a manifestation. But either way, it's still resurrection. There was also a very interesting legend that the Jesus's first resurrection did not occur at the crucifixion, but occurred when he was an initiate at the Egyptian temple. There was a level of the initiations where they would basically go into and again, very, very few were able to go through this, but they were able to go through essentially a death or a death-like experience and come back again. And there was a legend that Jesus first did that in Egypt. But everything that I have sensed in my own meditations, everything that I've read in the text, lead me to believe that it's entirely possible that a highly developed being, a high spiritual being like that, could achieve such a feat.
All right, let's take one or two more calls. West Springfield, Massachusetts, east of the Rockies. Hey, Bill, go ahead.
Yes, good morning, George. Good morning, Teresa and Peter.
Morning.
Hi.
Good morning.
Mother Teresa, 1997, had a vision. And that vision was published in Prophecy in the year 2002. Are you familiar with it?
I don't think I am. Can you tell me?
I'm not sure which one, what prophecy you'd be talking about now.
Okay. Mother Teresa saw a vision shortly before she died and told it to the nuns that were accompanying her in Calcutta. She had said that the fourth horseman will come as hope. It will not come as death, as Revelation says.
Mm-hmm.
And he will come when things are the very worst and the northern hemisphere winter bites hard, the fourth horseman makes his appearance. Do you think the horsemen are here? And my second question is, several months ago, NBC Nightly News showed a figure hovering over the temple of the rack. And it was just moving back and forth, wavering. And there was many, many people watching it for many, many hours. We just saw a short caption of it.
Right.
If you're aware of that, who do you think it is? I think it was the Holy Mother.
We've got a minute to go, you two.
Well, in the first place, I would say I'd love for you to email both Peter and I information about this, and maybe we can respond more fully when we have a little more time. But this is, I definitely think that these Kumaras, they come between the change of the ages. We're between the age of Pisces and Aquarius. I think we're due for one of them to come. And I do think that the divine feminine energy is also coming in to balance out the world and heal it.
All right, you two. Peter, thank you for being on the show. I'll look forward to seeing you at the Conscious Life Expo.
You are the best. I just got to tell you, you are a light in the world, and it's always an honor to be on the show.
It's been a great show, George. I'm really happy to be on with you and Trisha. Trisha, I'm finding my new partner here is like Superwoman. I don't think there's anything this lady doesn't know, and you're found the knowledge, too. So that was a great show.
Super. Thanks, both of you. Appreciate it. Their websites, of course, are linked up at coasttocoastam.com. We make it so easy for you to track our special guests. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesour, Stephanie Smith, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, John B. Wells, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.